Mrs. Freehough, I'm going to ask you, what was it like being the wife of such an illustrious rabbi?
Well, it's an ambivalent thing, I may say. In the first place, I must remind you that I came from a very private life. We had many friends, we were sociable, but a private life is completely different, as you realize, from a public life. And I was suddenly propelled into the position of being the wife of a rabbi of a large congregation. And if you will forgive whatever I have to say about my husband, it is hardly possible for me to be modest about him. The wife of a very brilliant man. It had its great advantages. It had a few shortcomings. One shortcoming was that everybody, I think, expected me to be as brilliant as he, and of course I wasn't. Secondly, a great deal was expected of the rabbi's wife. I made a very strenuous effort to learn the names of as many of the members as I could. We had a very large congregation, and it grew, and it grew. But I made a strong effort and succeeded fairly well in learning the names of our members, because Dr. Freehough was so occupied always that I felt if I could do that, it might assist him in some way. I tried to be as helpful in the sisterhood as I could without taking important offices. But I want to finish first with the great advantages of being the wife of Dr. Freehough, which were so much greater and so outweighed any little disadvantages. To be married to that, in the first place, very, very sweet-tempered man. I say that the Freehoffs are all angels. They have, there's a real sweetness in them. Dr. Freehough has a very equable temperament. He gets angry rarely. When he does, it's important. But he never shows temper. He has a questing mind that even today at 83, retired though he is, he never lets any opportunity for learning go by. It may be reading an unimportant article or an important article or an important book or an unimportant, it doesn't matter, whatever he's reading. If he comes across a word that he doesn't know, the dictionary is still open to him. This is a man who has never permitted his mind to stop, and I think it never will. Please God, I hope it won't. He is today as alert mentally as he ever was, and he fostered that in me. He made me curious about the world. I remember one occasion when we were standing on a railroad platform of a little tiny town waiting for this train to come in. This was a long, long time ago. There was a crate standing on the platform, and he said to me, "What do you think is in that crate?" I don't know what's in that, but I know what's in that crate. "Well, think about it. Look at the crate. Look the way it's packed. Think about it. Try to decide what it must hold." Well, that has been his attitude all through life. What does life hold? Think of that crate of life and try to decide what it's all about, always, constantly. Furthermore, because of his tremendous interest in his preaching and in his writing, he led me into writing. But perhaps you don't want to get into my writing angle yet, so we'll hold that back. But because of his career, he was already well established when we were married. He was 42, I was 28, he was 42. I didn't have to go through the early years of what some of the young rabbis have in struggling to maintain them, to attain a position and then maintain themselves. And some of the young wives have that to go through. I never had that. I married a man who was already very well established. And so I could only reap all the benefits, which was a tremendous thing for me too, you know. I had to learn to overcome my shyness and my desire to stay in the background as a private individual as I had been. I had to learn to be outgoing, which was not so easy because I was a very quiet, shy child. Even with three brothers, I was a bit tomboyish with them, but primarily my temperament was that of a shy, quiet person. And so I had to learn how to be a rabbi's wife.
Mrs. Freehart, I would like to know about some of the organizations and some of the things that you became involved in Pittsburgh.
I did. Of course, we have to realize that my primary interest had to be the sisterhood. But I also served on several boards. I served on the Gusky Home, the orphanage. Mr. Lewis Kaplan was president of the board at that time. And as you know, the home then was disbanded. Disbanded is no word. The home was given up when the foster home became so popular in scope. But for many years I served on that board. I served on the board of the Jewish Social Service Bureau. And I served on the Child Guidance Center Board, the Playhouse Board for many years. For 1 year I was its secretary, and then I refused to serve any further as secretary because, as you will recall, the Playhouse had a restaurant in connection with it, and the secretary was the one who had to apply for the liquor license, and I just didn't think it was quite the thing for a rabbi's wife to be asking for a liquor's license, so I asked them to excuse me as secretary after that first year. But I was on the Playhouse board until it went out of existence in the last couple of years. Then I also was one of the early founders of the Women's Division of the United Jewish Federation. I served as a co-chairman in one of the very early campaigns with Essie Abrams and Seal Silverstein. We were three co-chairmen together that year. And then when we decided to have the community day, such as we had last Thursday, of the Women's Division, I was the first chairman of that. And my beloved Rena Seltzer, of blessed memory, was my assistant in that. Now, those were the local organizations. Of course, I always served on our sisterhood board, but I would not take any such position as could lead into the presidency, for example, because I felt that in a large sisterhood such as this, there are so many capable women. The rabbi's wife is there. Her interest is there. She doesn't have to be wooed. And there were many women who enjoy having positions of authority, and I felt they should have them. I took only those positions that I felt needed starting or a little encouragement. You remember the Council of Jewish Women had its talent incorporated. At that same time, the sisterhood, I founded the 10 players for sisterhood, and I was its chairman for 1 year just to get it started, then gave up the chairmanship. The same thing happened with Braille, but I want to talk about Braille a little more fully later, so I'd like to get back to the sisterhoods first, the national sisterhood and the state. I was on the board of the Pennsylvania State Federation of Temple Sisterhoods. I had several positions on that board. I've forgotten some now. I haven't thought about them. But I was the founder and the first editor of the paper that the state is still putting out called Keystone Topics. And then I served as a national board member of the National Federation of Temple Sisterhoods. Now, on that board, I was served 1 year as chairman, national chairman of program, and 1 year as national chairman on nominations. Now, I've spoken already about organizing the Templars here in our own sisterhood. A really important piece of work that I like to talk about is the Braille. When I first came to Pittsburgh, I left back in Chicago a young cousin who had become blind. I was very sorry for him and for his plight, and that led me toward the study of Braille. Braille in those days was under the auspices of the Red Cross. It had become pretty defunct. Nothing much was being done. I did reach the chairman of those days, a Mrs. Chalfont, who loaned me a broken-down old Braille typewriter and gave me an out-of-date manual from which I studied the first three lessons. And then I sent them to Washington for approval. Washington then set me right and gave me the proper manual to study by, and I taught myself Braille. That was not the first thing I had taught myself. I had also taught myself cenotyping in Chicago. But I like machines of that kind, and so I find them not difficult to learn. I taught myself Braille. While I was learning Braille, and every lesson had to go to Washington to be corrected, and then you had to write a trial manuscript of 50 pages for certification. But when I got to about lesson four, I started the first Braille class here in Rhoda Sholem Sisterhood. Now, our Braille classes since that day, and that would be at least, I have to remember, 41 years. That's about 37 years ago. Every Braille class we have ever had has been open to the community. And in every single class we have ever had here, there have been women not affiliated with our sisterhood, Christian women as well as Jewish women. We have trained these women regardless of their affiliation with us. There have been women from B'nai Israel Temple who have gone back and started Braille groups in B'nai Israel. Some of these Christian women have gone back to their own churches and started Braille groups in their churches. One woman even went into the prisons and taught Braille in the Western Pennsylvania prison. So our Braille work was very important to us, and it reached the community as well as our own sisterhood. I was a Braille transcriber up until about 5 years ago when I broke my arm and found it difficult to continue for a while. I kept that chairmanship, however, for 5 years because I needed time to establish the group as it should be established. After 5 years, I turned the teaching and the chairmanship over to other members, and it has continued strong right up to today. There is still a class going on today, and women are being certificated constantly. I suppose in my time of transcribing, I wrote thousands of pages for the Jewish Braille Institute in New York and for the Library of Congress. Our women also have done a great deal of work for the blind school here, and now they do the large type typing for children with limited vision, also binding of manuscripts. So the Braille House was a very, very important part of my life for a long time, for many, many years, and I'm very happy to say that it is continuing. It happened during the Second World War that the Red Cross gave up the Braille work. It was taken over by the Library of Congress, so that ever since the Second World War days, it has been under the auspices of the Library of Congress. So too was our modern literature class, as you know, always open to the community. Of course, that was no direct connection with me, that was Dr. Freeholt. But it is very interesting to us to have women from right from around the country saying we had to move away from Pittsburgh, but there were a few Pittsburgh women in this community, and so we get the Carnegie Magazine and we hold little classes pretending that you're sitting there lecturing to us. We might walk down the street in Paris, France, and have someone come up and say to Dr. Pitt, oh, I used to be in your modern literature class. It's been fascinating from that point of view, you know. It had such a tremendous impact. Now, I think that, I don't know whether you would like me to talk now about my own writings or about my traveling with Dr. Freehoff, whichever you...
Well, we're going to cover both of that, and I would like to begin. You mentioned that Dr. Freehoff really encouraged you to write.
Yes.
And I wish you would begin to talk about that.
All right.
What you have done in your book